Good morning, and happy Friday to you all. It is my pleasure to introduce our chapel speaker today, Dr. Robert Chisholm, Department Chair and Senior Professor of Old Testament Studies. Dr. Chisholm grew up in upstate New York. He majored in journalism and history at Syracuse University before completing advanced degrees in biblical studies at Grace Theological Seminary and at Dallas Theological Seminary. He's taught at Dallas Seminary for 40 years and serving as department chair and senior professor of Old Testament studies. Dr. Chisholm, if you do that math correctly, teaching here for 40 years, it means that you started teaching Hebrew when you were five. Dr. Chisholm has published 7 books with 4 more on the way. He has also contributed to several books, published numerous reviews and articles in magazines and professional journals, and delivered several lectures and papers at academic conferences through the years. He served as a translator, editor, and or advisor for several Bible studies, study Bibles, and has written Bible studies for Coaches Outreach Ministry. Dr. Chisholm and his wife Deborah have been married for 47 years and have 2 adult children and 2 grandsons. The Chisholms are members at Lake Ridge Bible Church, where he participates in evangelistic outreach efforts and has taught an adult class for 29 years. Thank you for your faithfulness, friend. Would you please join me in welcoming Dr. Bob Chisholm today?
Good morning, brothers and sisters. Hope you're having a good day. I'm glad to be with you this morning. The title of my message is When the Lion's Claws Rip Your Skin. So we're going to be traveling a dark pathway, but I promise there'll be a light at the end of that pathway. And so before we enter into the dark pathway, I thought we'd think some happy thoughts. I want you to think of a happy time in your life when you were carefree and you look forward to each new day and what it would bring. I hope you've had a time like that in your life. They're few and far between, I think. But for me, no doubt about it, summer vacation during the elementary school years. Not junior high or high school when hormones complicated things. But we're talking elementary school summer vacation. We didn't have cell phones, we didn't have the internet, we didn't have video games, but we did have a couple of bats, and we had one of these, usually just one, a ball, and we had some gloves, which we sometimes had to exchange and borrow from others, but lots of sunshine, lots of green grass, and we played baseball every day, every day. Twice a week at night, we got to put our uniforms on and we played Little League baseball. Now, back in my day, it operated a little bit differently. Today, Little League teams have cool nicknames. You know, Cubs, Rangers, Cardinals, and if you're lucky, Yankees. But we didn't have nicknames like that. We were named after our sponsors. And it would be very difficult to try to come up with nicknames for some of these sponsors. Barbalik's Meat Market. Meat Cutters. Dangler's Electric. Shockers. That would work. The O.S. Clark Funeral Home. Well, that's going to be a challenge. Embalmers or something like that. Well, I played for Sisters Inn. And we hated the name of our sponsor, since it had a girl's noun in it. But we played for Sisters Inn. And I was a shortstop. And shortstops have to make strong, accurate throws to first base. And I could do that. So my coaches got the idea that I would make a good pitcher. The season before we'd gone undefeated, our star pitcher had graduated to Pony League. And so we needed some pitching, and so the coaches thought, well, we'll start with our third baseman and our shortstop. They've got good arms. So at first, the experiment seemed to work. In my first start in Little League, I struck out 18 batters in 6 innings. Little League games are 6 innings long, and so do the math. Every out was a strikeout. But despite my apparent success, and I did win the game, there was a hint of trouble. There was a crack in the foundation. I walked 11 batters. I threw several wild pitches, and I also hit a couple batters, much to the chagrin of the mothers who were seated in their lawn chairs over behind the bench of the opposing team. I think my nickname was the terrorist or something like that. So in my next start, the crack in the foundation opened very, very wide, and I fell in. I walked a ton of batters. I made one kid cry. I can still see it in my mind. I plunked him in the back with a fastball, and I can still see it in my mind's eye to this day. He just started weeping and crying. Doesn't make you popular with the mothers in the crowd. I almost threw one pitch over the backstop. I can still see it rising. My brother was the catcher. We were playing in hostile territory, and there were fans back there who would actually make fun of players. My brother was the catcher. He was a little plump, and he got the ball, and he came back out to me. He says, "Don't do that." He says, "Those people are all making fun of me back there. They're calling me names. I do not want to have to run back to the backstop." But I almost put it right over the backstop. My teammates came unglued. They started making errors, and we lost. And I was blaming everybody except myself for what was happening. And I remember standing there just shouting at my teammates, "You idiot, can't you catch a ball? Can't you throw a ball properly?" Well, when I got home, my father, who was one of our coaches, sat me down for a talk. He didn't do this when we were out there. He didn't publicly embarrass me, but we had to have a talk. And my father was all about teamwork. He was a fighter pilot in World War II, flew an F-6F Hellcat off the deck of the USS Yorktown. And for fighter pilots, teamwork was the difference between life and death. When you're going out on a recon mission or a sweep or a strike, you've got to work together as a team. And he was a wingman for a great pilot, Truman Place. And so he was all about teamwork. That always came through in everything he did. And he told me, he said, "Listen, if you ever yell at your teammates again and you lose your cool on the field, it will be your last game that you ever play. I don't care how good you are, it will be your last game." Well, I got mad, and I've always had trouble controlling my tongue, especially when I'm mad. And so I said some things that angered my father, and before I knew it, my father had me over his knee, and I got the last spanking that I ever experienced. I had disrespected my father, and I paid the consequences. The worst part of it wasn't the physical pain. That was over in a matter of seconds. The worst part, I think, was the sense of alienation that I felt from my father, the pain of knowing I had disappointed him, looking into his eyes and seeing the anger and the disappointment. He didn't want to have to do this. Consequences. It's not a popular word among the human race, and it hasn't been since day one. It wasn't popular in the Garden of Eden, where Adam and Eve tried to dodge consequences and blame someone else for their sin. When the Lord confronted Adam, what was his response? "The woman that you gave me." When the Lord turned to the woman, Eve, and said, "What's going on here?" She said, "The serpent tricked me." Today, people still try to avoid consequences by denying guilt, blaming others, or just going on their merry way, thinking somehow that they're going to be an exception to the rule. But despite our attempts to dodge or ignore consequences, they are inevitable. And as Robert Louis Stevenson, 19th century author, said, "Everybody, soon or late, sits down to a banquet of consequences. If I go up on the roof and jump off, there's going to be a consequence. I'm going to crash." And just as there are physical consequences, there are also moral consequences. God has rigged the world in this way. Lydia Child, who was a 19th century advocate for the oppressed, said this, "But men never violate the laws of God without suffering the consequences, sooner or later. And consequences don't have feelings." Author George Eliot, whose real name was Mary Ann Evans, and that's a story for another day, said, "Consequences are unpitying. If I jump off the roof, the concrete below will not take pity on me and turn into something soft so I can have a happy landing. It's not the way it works." King David certainly discovered this to be true. The last part of David's story, after his murder of Uriah, as recorded in 2 Samuel 13 through 20, is a story about consequences. Inevitable, unpitying, painful consequences. And don't worry, we're not going to work through that entire section verse by verse. We're not going to do that today. I can't imagine how painful it would be to lose a child. As a consequence of his sin, David lost four of them. Remember what he told the prophet Nathan when Nathan told him about the rich man who stole the poor man's sheep. Not realizing that the story was actually about him, David said the culprit must pay fourfold for his sin. And that's according to the Old Testament law, which says if you steal a sheep, you pay back four. That was the way it worked. But then Nathan shocked David with these words, "You are the man." And as the story unfolds, count them up, David loses four sons. He loses the anonymous baby that was born to Bathsheba, then Amnon, then Absalom, and then Adonijah. All of the deaths were premature, and three of them were violent. Adonijah's death, the fourth installment in David's payment, actually came after David's death. At that point, God stamped David's account paid in full. But the consequences of David's sin followed him even beyond his lifetime. So let's take a closer look at how this all played out. Let's take that journey down that dark path for a few minutes. And we'll look at the anatomy of David's consequences. After God took the baby, he simply stepped back and allowed nature to take its course. David's sin, his one-night stand with Bathsheba, his murder of her husband Uriah, was all about power. He abused the power of his privileged position as king, and then he desperately used deceit and violence to cover up his crimes so that he could hold on to his position of power. And David's children followed in their father's footsteps. That's often the way consequences work. David had viewed Bathsheba as an object, as someone to gratify his physical desires. And in chapter 13 of 2 Samuel, Amnon viewed his half-sister, Tamar, the same way, as someone to satisfy his lust. And he used deceit to get her to come down to his house and come into his room. He pretended he was sick, and he asked his father if Tamar could come and nurse him back to health and make a meal for him. And David sent her down to his house, not knowing what Amnon planned to do. When Tamar resisted his advances, Amnon used his power, his physical strength, to overwhelm her and humiliate her. And there are echoes of David's sin in the story. David had sent for Bathsheba. Then he sent for Uriah. And then he sent Uriah back to the battle lines, carrying his own death warrant in his hands. All of that was cold and calculating. But now he sends Tamar to her demise. This time he's in the dark, just like Uriah had been. David possesses absolute authority as king. He sends people where he wills. And by a mere message, he accomplishes his desires. But he uses his power to satisfy his lust and cover up his crime. And in chapter 13, he continues to exercise his authority over others, but now it backfires on him as the Lord oversees the fulfillment of his self-imposed penalty. 2 Samuel 11:4 says that David's sin describes in a very matter-of-fact way. She came to him and he lay with her. Those same words show up on Amnon's lips in 2 Samuel 13:11. "Come, lie with me, my sister, The verbal correlation drives home the point, like father, like son. When David, paralyzed by his own past, did nothing about this terrible crime, Absalom, who was Tamar's full brother, decided to take matters into his own hands. He plotted Amnon's death, and he waited for 2 years until just the right occasion. Absalom insisted that all his brothers, including Amnon, join him and his men for the sheep shearing. And once again, David unknowingly sent his son Amnon and put him in harm's way. And at just the right time, after Amnon was drunk, Absalom gave the signal, and his men brutally killed Amnon. And again, there are echoes of David's sin. Absalom tells his men to strike and kill Amnon. Those are the same words that David used when he told Joab, his general, to draw back from Uriah so he would be struck down and killed. It's as if Uriah's death is being replayed. But now the victim is David's firstborn, favorite son, Amnon. David used deceit to kill a loyal soldier, Uriah. Absalom used deceit to kill his half-brother. Convinced that his father was unfit to rule, Absalom tried to take David's throne. And the Lord allowed him to drive David from Jerusalem. But in the end, as you know, the Lord delivered David. And in the process, Absalom, David's new favorite son, died a brutally violent death at the hands of Joab, the same man who had been David's hitman when he killed Uriah. Once again, there are echoes of David's sin in the account of Absalom's death. David had instructed Joab, as we said before, to withdraw from Uriah during the assault on the city, so he would be struck down and die. The verbs are the same ones used in 2 Samuel 18:15 to describe how Joab's men finished off Absalom after Joab had apparently driven 3 spears into him. The whole scene is reminiscent of the death of Boromir at the hands of the Urukai. By the end of the scene, Absalom looks like an oversized pincushion. When the news of Absalom's death reaches David, he comes unglued. His body shook physically. He expressed his wish that he could have died instead of his son. 5 times he shouts out, "Absalom, Absalom," 5 times. 8 times he cries out, "My son, my son." It's painful to read. But don't miss the justice in all of this. There's one person in this story that deserves our pity more than any other, and that is Tamar, David's daughter and the victim of rape. When people abuse power and resort to violence, there's always collateral damage. Innocent people who get stomped on by the power mongers. Tamar is the innocent victim in this story. After her humiliating experience, she put ashes on her head and she wept loudly. And then she lived as a desolate woman in her brother Absalom's house. And David never did anything about it. So as we see David weeping here, it's as if Tamar's tears have become his. Finally, he knows how she felt. And maybe that's one of the reasons that God disciplines people who hurt others. He wants them to know how it feels to be a victim. Maybe until that happens, it's impossible to be truly repentant. C.S. Lewis captures this concept in Book 5 of the Chronicles of Narnia, entitled The Horse and His Boy. The story is about the adventures of a poor boy named Shasta and his companion, the self-centered aristocrat Princess Aravis. They are escaping from the evil land of Calormen. Shasta from slavery and Aravis from a forced betrothal and a very cruel stepmother. In order to escape, Aravis drugged the female servant who was assigned to her. And when Shasta asked Aravis what happened to the servant, she replied, "Doubtless she was beaten for sleeping late. But she was a tool and spy of my stepmother's. I am very glad they should beat her." Well, Shasta objected. That was hardly fair. And Erebus flippantly replied, I did not do any of these things for the sake of pleasing you. Well, during their escape from Kellerman, a lion periodically appeared, helping them reach their destination, though they didn't realize it at the time. In fact, on one occasion, the lion clawed Erebus's back. The lion, of course, was the great Aslan. And later, once he has revealed himself to Shasta and Erebus, he explains to Erebus why he did this. The scratches on your back, tear for tear, throb for throb, blood for blood, were equal to the stripes laid on the back of your stepmother's slave because of the drugged sleep you cast upon her. You needed to know what it felt like. I had an experience like this not too long ago. Several years. Time flies. Who knows? It might have been 10 years ago. It seems like it was just the other day. But I had my computer stolen from the faculty lounge on second floor, Todd. It was in between classes, and I was on my way to class, and the hallways were just lined with students. And I had my computer bag with me, and I went into the faculty lounge, and no one was in there. And so I just laid my bag on one of the dining tables and ducked into the bathroom for about a minute, came back out, grabbed my bag, and my bag felt light. So I looked inside it, and I said, oh, I must have forgot to put my computer in my bag. So I rushed down to my office. No computer. It was sort of like Uncle Billy in It's a Wonderful Life. Remember when he loses the money and he starts running back through the streets, goes back to his office looking for the money that he was going to deposit when in reality Mr. Potter stole it from him. And I suddenly realized someone just stole my computer bag. Not my bag, my computer. Among those students, I'm assuming it wasn't a student who did it. There was someone who had infiltrated the ranks and was acting like a student. This wouldn't have happened back in the old days when we all had to wear suits like this. People would have had a hard time infiltrating. But I found out later from campus police that, yes, there had been someone on campus and he was doing dastardly deeds that afternoon, and they never caught him as far as I know. I was thankful that my computer was backed up. But that afternoon, the Lord put a thought into my mind. And all of a sudden, I was back at good old Syracuse University in the dorm with my dorm mates. And one night, a group of, I would call them children, junior high at most. I mean, they were street urchins. They looked like something right out of a Dickens novel. And they come in knocking on our door, and they've got all kinds of loot. They've got all kinds of stuff. And we said, hey, you got some good stuff here. We're selling it. I said, I like that hunting jacket there, that black and red hunting jacket. How much you selling that for? $1. I said, I'll buy it. And I wore that hunting jacket, and I really enjoyed it. I thought it was really cool. And I wore it for several years. And then for some reason, my mind went back. And you know what I saw in my mind's eye? I saw a man returning to his car. And the window was smashed out. And he looked inside. And his possessions, all of his valuable possessions that he had in there were gone, including his hunting jacket. And I think for the first time in my life, I realized what I had done. I had bought a stolen item. Didn't think anything about it, and for the first time in my life, I probably experienced what that person experienced when that jacket was stolen. And as David wept uncontrollably over Absalom, he finally knew how Tamar had felt when her future was ripped from her by Amnon. Well, maybe you're thinking, I thought God forgave David. Why would God treat David so harshly? Well, it's a bitter pill to swallow. But that's the way consequences work. God is perfectly just, and you reap what you sow. Donna Rice, a Christian who strayed from the right path and got involved in an affair with politician Gary Hart back in the 80s and suffered some very negative consequences after that, put it this way. In my case, I learned that although God loves us, he doesn't grant us immunity from the consequences of our choices. And David realized that. And as the consequences of his sin played out in his experience, he didn't complain. Sure, he expressed his pain and his grief through his tears and in some psalms, but he submitted to God's discipline. When David was leaving Jerusalem and running from his son Absalom, who was bent on killing him, a man named Shimei met David. Shimei, who was a relative of Saul, he was a Benjaminite, he hated David. And as David passed by, Shimei called curses down on David. He threw rocks at him, and he falsely accused David of having murdered Saul and his relatives. And one of David's nephews volunteered to kill Shimei with one sword blow, off with the head. But David wouldn't let him. And here's what David said. "Let him alone. Let him curse, for the Lord has told him to. It may be that the Lord will look upon my misery and restore to me his covenant blessing." He accepted Shimei's false accusations as further discipline. I think he realized that the Lord was letting David know how it felt to be a victim unfairly. And he hoped the Lord would mercifully vindicate him, and the Lord did that. Shimei's curses on David were not fulfilled because they were based on false accusations. God was punishing David for the crimes that he did commit. He wasn't punishing him unjustly for things he did not do. Which leads to my next point. There's a silver lining in the story. We're off the dark path now. There's a light. There's a silver lining in the story. And this is where this message kind of takes a turn for the better. God did forgive David. And believe it or not, the consequences were not as severe as they could have been. God could have taken David's throne away from him, and he actually was justified in taking David's life. But he showed mercy, and he spared his life. God had promised David that he would not abandon him, as he had done to Saul, and he didn't. In fact, right after the death of their infant son, Bathsheba, whom David had married, got pregnant again. And they had a son and named him Solomon. His name means peace. But the Lord wanted to give Solomon another name as well, and he did so through Nathan. And that name was Jedidiah, loved by the Lord. And I think that softened the blow of the divine discipline. Earlier, God had sent Nathan to confront David's sin and announce his punishment. Now he sends Nathan with a message of comfort and hope. And through this second visit, it was as if God said, "You know, I still love you, and I still want to use you, and I'm going to use this child." Well, I told you earlier about my ill-fated attempt to be a starting pitcher when I was in Little League, which ended up with me on my father's knee, experiencing the deserved consequences for my insolence and disrespect. But there is a sequel to that episode. Later that season, after I had returned to being a shortstop, we were in a close game, clinging to a one-run lead in the final inning. And the opposing team loaded the bases with nobody out. My father walks to the mound, takes the ball from the pitcher, turns to me, and does this. Motions me to come to the mound. And he said, "Bobby, I want you to pitch." And I replied, "But Dad, remember what happened before. I'll just walk in the tying run and the winning run, and who knows what's going to happen after that, and I don't want to get spanked again." And he said, "Well, the only way we're going to get out of this is if somebody strikes out the side, strikes out every hitter from this point on. We can't take a risk of someone putting the ball in play. You can throw really hard, and you can do this." He said, "Just relax. Pretend you're at shortstop, throwing to first base." I wish somebody told me that earlier, by the way. I went with a no windup and everything. I just threw the ball as if I was fielding it and going to throw it to first base. And I threw 9 straight strikes. Nobody touched the ball. Struck out the next 3 hitters, and we won the game. They still didn't use me as a pitcher after that. By showing confidence in me, my father was assuring me that my failure was in the past. It didn't need to be a barrier to the future. And so it was with David. In his final words recorded in 2 Samuel 23, 1 through 7, he called himself the man exalted by the Most High, the man anointed by the God of Jacob. He rejoiced that God had made an everlasting covenant with him, that he had saved him and answered his prayers. And in the end, we see a man who's confident in his relationship with God. Yes, David had learned that in God's world, those who violate God's laws suffer unpitying consequences. But he was also able to rest secure in God. And God writes the epitaph on David's life in 1 and 2 Kings. And it's very, very troubling to a lot of people. In passage after passage, he holds David up as the model of a king who was loyal to the Lord. And if you look at those contexts, he's focusing really on the fact that David was a pure worshiper and he didn't worship idols. But you're thinking, now, did the author of Kings, does he know about Samuel? Has he read Samuel? Does he know about that? Doesn't he know about what happened with Uriah? Yeah, he does. He only mentions it once. In one of those texts, he says, except in the matter of Uriah the Hittite. So I know about that. But the Lord has chosen not to focus on that. And so David's forgiveness at that point was complete. It reminds me of a scene in C.S. Lewis's The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. Edmund had sold out to the White Witch. And he brought all kinds of trouble down upon himself and upon Narnia. And he had suffered some painful consequences for his actions. And just as the witch is sharpening her knife, preparing to cut Edmund's throat, Aslan rescues him. And then Aslan brings Edmund to his brother Peter and his sisters Susan and Lucy. And Aslan says this, "Here is your brother, and there is no need to talk to him about what is past." Well, earlier in the message, I shared with you a couple incidents involving my father and myself long ago when I was 12 years old. I want to share one more. Let's turn the clock ahead 33 years. My father is now 72, and I'm 45, and he's dying of cancer. And he put his hands on my face, and he looked deeply into my eyes, and he said, "I'm so glad you're here. I love you so much." And you know what? He didn't say anything about the spanking so many years ago. He probably had forgotten about it. Didn't say anything about that. That was over. No need to talk about that anymore. And I rested confidently in my father's love, knowing that even that discipline many years before had been an expression of his undying love for me. So as we conclude here, I want you to think about some questions. Aren't you glad that we have a God who is so fair and just that he disciplines us when we deserve it? A God who loves us so much that he disciplines us when we need it. But aren't you also glad that we have a God who then says there's no need to talk about what is past? A God who looks into our eyes and says, "I love you so much." Father, please apply your word to the hearts of your people, my sisters and my brothers. And it's in Jesus' name that we pray. Amen.